Welcome to Energy in Action. I'm your host, Marcy Young, and as a Mito patient myself, I appreciate you and the community you've helped us to build. This podcast honors the triumphs and struggles of patients and families affected by this disease and celebrates the work being done by doctors and researchers every day to make it a safer world for our people. We are a support group and a podcast focusing on all things related to mitochondrial disease. Welcome to another episode of Energy in Action. I'm really excited to have our guest today, Dr. Jerry Vackley, on. Oftentimes on this podcast, we talk to patients who have mitochondrial disease and their families. We talk to a lot of people from nonprofits and different organizations. But today we are talking to a physician who is, you know, every day working on the development and advancement of care for people like us, people in our mitochondrial disease community. And I feel fortunate to be talking to him about some things that maybe wouldn't be discussed in a normal, you know, doctor-patient visit. But I'm looking forward to everyone hearing from him. This is, you know, he is not my physician, but I have heard such wonderful things about him throughout my experience with MitoAction, and people really, really hold him very high in their feelings of, you know, kind of getting through all of what they get through on a daily basis. So I'm just going to run through a quick biography of Dr. Vackley, and then we're going to get started. He is the Cleveland Family Endowed Pediatric Research at the School of Medicine. He is a professor of human genetics at the Graduate School of Public Health, and this is all at the Children's Hospital of Pittsburgh. He's also the Chief of Genetic and Genomic Medicine at the Children's Hospital of Pittsburgh and the Director of the Center for Rare Disease Therapy at the Children's Hospital of Pittsburgh. He has received his undergraduate degree at Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh and received his degree in medicine and genetics from the University of Pennsylvania School of Medicine in Philadelphia. He completed his pediatric residency at the University of Colorado Health Science Center and his postdoctoral fellowship in human genetic and pediatrics at Yale University School of Medicine in New Haven, Connecticut. Before assuming his current position in Pittsburgh, he was the chair of medical genetics in the Mayo Clinic School of Medicine. So he's just dabbled a little bit in mitochondrial care. And I know he also heavily specializes in fatty acid oxidation disorders. We're going to be talking about that as well today. So welcome, Dr. Vackley.
Thanks. You always make me feel so old.
But you're 27, right?
That's right. Or at least I'm on my 40th anniversary of it.
Well, you know, as we kind of talked about before, I don't know the answers of most of these questions of my own physicians that I personally see, but I think it's a really great idea to kind of give, you know, more of yourself to the mitochondrial community and let people see you as not only the biography that we just gave, but also, you know, more on like how you got into this. You know, there's a lot of doctors that we see, me and other mitochondrial patients around the world, that see physicians that don't even know how to care for mitochondrial care. So I'm really curious to see how you got into this world.
So, you know, I tell people I'm really boring. I stumbled into genetics as an undergraduate. I did undergraduate research in genetics. I thought, oh, this is really cool. I'm gonna go and do medical school, but I'm gonna do this PhD in genetics at the same time. Then I found out that there was a discipline in clinical genetics, and I said, okay, so I'm gonna do clinical genetics. And when I had to, they didn't have a primary residency in genetics back then; it was a fellowship, so you had to do something else. So I went to my pediatric residency, and they said, well, what are you gonna do? I said, I'm gonna do genetics. And when I finished pediatrics, I did genetics, and then I got what my mother kept insisting on calling my first real job at the Mayo Clinic as a faculty in genetics. So like I said, it's kind of boring. I can't tell you what it was that first caught my interest, but boy, once it hit, everything just kept layering on, and it was there just was no other career for me. I don't know how to say it any other way. I can't possibly imagine doing anything else now, and I couldn't imagine doing anything else back then.
I think that you make a huge impact on a community that feels very unseen, and we all thank you so much for that. So you see patients in Pittsburgh, and I'm guessing patients come from a very wide range of geographic areas to come see you, but you also spend time doing research, correct?
Yes. In fact, most of my time these days is in research because it's just so time consuming.
I can imagine. So tell us, what kind of research adventures are you working on right now? What are you hoping to achieve in the next year with the research you're doing now?
Research adventure is a great description of it. I need to go back just a little bit to explain to you that in clinical genetics, in medical genetics, when I started, it really was a field that was mostly site diagnose based. You look at a patient and you said, oh, I recognize these features, and I call it a name. I give it a name. But there was nothing that was a part of that told you anything about the syndrome, what caused it. The big advances in those early years came in the development of new diagnostic technologies. And ultimately, we were able to do the kind of metabolic testing that most of the folks who are likely to be listening to this know about, blood and urine, looking for chemicals that are indicative of a biochemical imbalance and allow one to start thinking about the possibility of a diagnosis of one of these diseases. And so the middle portion of what I did was really much more trying to transition from saying, well, we see a chemical and we define the name of the disease by that chemical, primary lactic acidosis, or a finding, a brain lesion that's consistent with Leigh syndrome, for example. And instead, looking at it at the DNA level as in the pre-human genome era and characterizing disorders. The problem with that was that it really didn't help us a whole lot with therapy. And so the last third of my career has really been predicated now on the additional improvement in and changes in technologies that have allowed us to move forward into therapy. And now almost everything I do in my lab is therapy based. I was fortunate enough to have developed a drug triheptanoin, which your fatty acid oxidation patient listeners will know as the only FDA approved drug for those group of disorders, for that group of disorders. And it's great. It helps, but it's not a cure. And so we continue to look for new things that will either augment the treatment with triheptanoin or replace it with something better. And ultimately, the area that I'm super excited about right now is we are in the process of developing our first gene therapy for one of this group of disorders, the fatty acid oxidation defects. And it's really looking quite good and could be in clinical trials in a couple, 3 years. So that's a remarkable change. Keep in mind, when I started this path, fatty acid oxidation disorders didn't exist. We didn't know about them. So everything that's happened in the field of fatty acid oxidation disorders, I've seen in my professional career. And to go from not knowing what they are to being able to cure them is just like, you know, it's the Holy Grail.
Right. That's a really big deal. Do you only see, when you do see patients, do you only see patients with FAOD?
No, I have to say I see mostly patients with FAOD, but I have a lot of patients in Pittsburgh who I've diagnosed with respiratory chain deficiencies, the other mitochondrial energy disorders, I like to call them. I still do treat primary mitochondrial myopathy. And then I still also do hospital service. So in the hospital, you take care of whatever happens to walk in through the door when you're on call. And it, from a genetic standpoint, I mean, and so it keeps me fresh.
You must have so much free time, right?
Yeah.
I am so impressed with everything you're saying, that you're working toward a new therapy that could be in clinical trials soon, that you still are you know, taking care of other patients in the hospital in terms of genetics, obviously. But I'm just very impressed.
Well, don't give me too big a head. As my mother would say, you're just doing your job. You're just doing your job. It's my passion. My wife and I, my wife's a genetic counselor.
So you
can imagine what the conversations at dinner turn out to be. So needless to say, our kids both went into something besides medicine because they said, you guys.
Too much. So you have two kids?
I do.
And neither of them went into medicine. So they're grown.
They are grown. They're both in their 30s, and they took up our hobbies for their careers, which you know, I'm a little jealous, but not too much. They seem to have found life paths that are right for them, and that's all you can ask.
Right. I'm a mom, and I feel like all I care about is that my kids are kind and that they're content in their own hearts. You know, I don't care if they're the smartest kid in the room.
Always a good policy.
Right. So what are these hobbies of yours that they've taken up as careers? I'm curious.
Well, so my older son is a sound designer and director in theater. His first exposure to being a sound engineer and being involved in sound came. My wife and I actually met participating in a music group. We're both amateur musicians, and we've actually played in groups for our entire lives and our entire married lives. And when our son was about six, we have pictures of him standing at our soundboard playing with the controls. And it got to the point where as he got older, people would come up to us afterwards and say, well, you guys sounded really good today. And I said, no, we sounded the same as we always did. Aaron knows how to run the soundboard and makes us sound better. He can cut out the mistakes. So he's now doing that as a profession and quite good at it, I'm proud to say.
That's really cool. But I just want to be clear. So you and your wife are both in genetics, but you met in a music scene.
Absolutely.
What are the chances?
That is correct. Who knew? Well, neither of us were really geneticists back then. I mean, this was undergrad. So that was at the very beginning of both of us. And then my other son, we've always big into outdoors activities, backpacking, kayaking, canoeing, camping, hiking, cross country skiing when we lived in Colorado. And the kids grew up doing that. We always say we've got the only children who've never been to Disney World. We took them to the real world instead. Our vacations were in the backcountry, hiking, camping, kayaking. He did a number of things in his high school years that was focused on environmentalism. And for example, went out to Yosemite and worked for about 3 weeks doing trail reclamation work and eventually got a degree in outdoor education and followed that with a master's in environmental nonprofit management. And so we call him our tree hugger. And that's what he does for his life.
Wow. They really have made successful careers out of hobbies/passions.
That's exactly right.
Well, it sounds like they're doing really well. So you've told us about your hobbies. Now, when you take us back to when you were in undergrad and in medical school, I'm so glad you continued with your studies and you've made such an impact in our community. Did you ever second guess yourself?
Told you I'm boring. No, I never did. This is always what I wanted to do. I tell students who come to me and ask about a career like this, I say, you know what? The only reason to do something like this is because you just can't imagine doing anything else. Because otherwise, it's too hard. People say, how long did you train? I say, well, it depends on when you start counting. I from the time I graduated high school till I got what my mother kept insisting on calling my first real job was 17 years.
Oh, my gosh.
The only thing I can say is that through that whole time, it felt like I was just doing what I knew I was going to be doing for the rest of my life. So it never really felt like a challenge or a hardship because I was doing what I wanted to do for the rest of my life. I mean, how much more exciting can it be than when you wake up in the morning knowing that you could be going to work and looking at the results of an experiment and suddenly thinking, you know what? I now know something that nobody else in the world knows.
It's a really good way to put it.
anytime you have gone into the lab and created experiments and created research, it has been because of something you saw in a patient.
Absolutely. I can give you a complete example of a disease completely unrelated to what we're talking about, but it's an example of why I would do something like that. So I moved to Pittsburgh in 2004, and I saw very early on in my clinic time here a young girl who was 12, and she had this horrendous case of whole body psoriasis, a very malignant kind of rash that was, you know, just precluded a normal life. And she'd been going to physicians all her life, and they've been treating the psoriasis, or eczema, sometimes it got called. Wasn't even clear what it was. But when I saw her, I recognized that not only did she have this rash, she was very small for her age. She had a very small head size for her age. She hadn't started showing any signs of sexual maturity. And I thought, well, you know, this is more than just a rash. I thought about what I thought I knew. And I said, well, I have an idea what this might be. So I sent some samples off to look for a group of disorders called defects in sterol metabolism, steroid hormone metabolism, because it would have explained a lot of what was going on. And I got the test back from my old friends at the Mayo Clinic. I had just left there, so I sent this back to them. And they said, well, you know, it's normal. And I, no, come on, how could this be normal? She's got all the signs that should be there if this was a part of one of these disorders. And well, first of all, they're all lethal in the newborn period, or very soon thereafter. So, you know, she wouldn't be 12. And there was just nothing there. I said, well, what did you test for? And the answer came back, probably not surprisingly, well, we tested for everything we know about. So, you know, that's a challenge to a scientist. I said, okay, how about the things you don't know about? And of course, there was dead silence on the other end of the line. And so I went into the laboratory. We developed the techniques to look more broadly instead of just the things we know about, everything that might come out in this pathway. We identified a chemical that shouldn't have been there, and then went back to the textbooks and said, okay, where is this pathway likely to be? And then went to genetic techniques to actually identify the gene that we predicted was not working in her, was in fact not working. And so we went from a complete unknown to having used all of the standard diagnostic techniques that were available to working up something in the laboratory that allowed us to figure out what she had. Now, of course, I met with the parents after this, and I was feeling pretty smug about it, and said, okay, so now we know what she has. And I, you know, they were not at all impressed. Of course, what they said was, well, now what are you going to do to treat her? Put me in my place.
Came down from your high.
Yeah, absolutely. So I said, well, let me think about that one for a while. So I thought about it. There's a drug that everybody knows about that is designed to block entry into this pathway. And I said, well, what if we use that drug and we blocked entry into this pathway and we stopped the accumulation of this chemical, this toxic chemical that was accumulating? Maybe that would help. Well, we gave it to her and she had a little bit of improvement, but not a lot. And especially her skin didn't get any better. So I went to our research pharmacologist and I said, well, why might this not be helping the skin? And he looked at me like, well, what do you mean? This stuff doesn't get to the skin. You should know that. Okay, thank you. So now I know it. What can we do about it? And they said, well, we'll make you a cream so you can just put it on her skin. Oh, that sounds great. So they did. And the combination of giving her this drug plus using the cream, within 8 months, her skin had completely cleared. She had crossed from being well under the growth curve to now being on the 10th percentile, and she started going through puberty.
Oh my gosh.
So it worked.
Wow.
And that's the kind of thing you can do when you have the freedom to go in the laboratory and not take I don't know for an answer when you're mm-hmm. when you're dealing with a patient.
Wow. Our community needs more people like you, but we are very, very lucky to have you.
you know, to have someone with this attitude, you know, in the rare disease world, it's hard to find, as I said before, it's hard to find sometimes doctors that even know what mitochondrial disease is. And then to have a doctor that is so well trained and so well, you know, has such high energy for really making it better for our community. So I really appreciate it. So I've heard a bit about this organization called Inform that you are the chair of. And I would love for you to tell us a little bit about, you know, your work in it and how you got into it. And I mean, I guess it's pretty clear how you got into it, but you know, what kinds of things you're doing within this Inform organization.
Sure. Well, I actually started it.
I had a feeling you did. I thought you did, but I didn't want to say it incorrectly. So, okay. So he founded Inform.
The initials stand for the International Network for Fatty Acid Oxidation Research and Management. How's that?
Wow.
And it took me a long time to come up with those, with something that made sense for an acronym.
Yeah. I'm sure most of your life is spent talking about like the science behind the FAOD conditions and mitochondrial disease overall. So I am sure our community would love to learn a few other things about you. So I have four very quick questions. Where is somewhere you would like to travel that you've never been?
Any place I've never been. I love to travel. I'll tell you the place that I've never been. Don't think I'm going to get there, but I would love to go. Antarctica.
I knew you were going to say that when you said that you didn't think you'd get there because you don't create boundaries for yourself. That's very clear. So when you said that you probably wouldn't get there, I knew it was a place that you probably, there's no other place like that, right?
There's no other place like that. That's right.
Yeah. I'm sure you would really enjoy, thoroughly enjoy and learn so much if you were able to get there, actually. And what is a food you can't live without? It's okay if it's not healthy.
I'm really fortunate. My wife is an honest-to-goodness gourmet cook. She's taken cooking lessons for many, many years. I would say that whatever she's making for dinner, I can't live without. There are lots of ethnic dishes that I grew up with. My mother is Croatian, and so there are some Croatian dishes that are just comfort food. And boy, if you told me I could never have my mother's version of stuffed cabbage, which in Croatian is called sarma, I would probably deflate to about half my size.
Oh, yeah, the comfort things are very important. So you mentioned that you're into music and you play yourself. What do you play? What instruments do you play?
Oh, I play about, I always lose count, about eight or 10 instruments.
Oh my God.
And started back in high school with folk music and a guitar. And over the years I've learned how to play bass and mountain dulcimer and mandolin and mandola and bouzouki. And I think there's some things in there that I'm missing, but mostly string, mostly folk, yeah. Folk bass instrument.
That's so interesting. So what's the best concert you've ever been to?
Oh, you never get a straight answer from me out of that one. usually it's the last one I've been to, but, you know, these days I've done a lot of traveling in Ireland and I got to the point where I enjoyed the music so much that I just had to learn to play it. So that's where I picked up the mandolin and the mandola, a couple of Irish instruments. And one of the benefits of COVID for me was that there was a lot of free time. So that's when I learned to play those. And I went from listening to Irish music to learning how to play it to actually going into the bars in Ireland and playing.
You've played the instruments in bars in Ireland?
I have indeed.
That's so fun.
It is. It is. I would never call myself accomplished, but I was good enough not to get thrown out. Let's put it that way. It was great fun. I love to listen to other people play, but I also love to play.
And what is your favorite way to stay active? That's your last question, and then you're off the hook.
Favorite way to stay active? Well, we still like going out and doing things. These days in the outdoors, it tends to be more sort of day hikes, but with our dogs, so that's always fun. I play my music, and that pretty much keeps me busy. If I'm not doing that, I'm reading.
Oh, wow. You are an incredible guy. I think it's been so enjoyable to kind of get to know you beyond the, you know, stuff that that a patient and a doctor talk about. And I'm so thrilled that you were able to kind of come to Energy in Action and kind of give more of yourself to our community. And our whole community appreciates it. I think this is going to be a really fun and enjoyable and a remarkable listen for everyone. And thanks again for you to put your research here, to put all of this amazing energy that you have into the rare disease world. I mean, there's conditions and diseases and ailments that you hear about, you know, very often, and ours isn't one of them. And it gives me hope to hear that there are people like you who are really driving so strategically to make life better for us. So I thank you.
Oh, you're welcome.
It's been a pleasure getting to know you.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Of course.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for joining us. I encourage you to browse other Energy in Action podcast episodes. I'm so inspired by the resilience of those in previous episodes, and I know you will be too.